Hey, 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 closet busters and bold move makers. It is time once again for Life Uncloset. So I want you to gather around because it is time once again to kick down those closet doors of your life. We're here to escape our BS, explore our fears, and elevate our self-expression. I'm your host, Rick Clemons. I'm the bold move expert and that coming out guy who's going to take you to the party, the pulpit, the wake, and back to the party of living your life uncloset. So come on along with me and grab hold of yourself and get ready to step out, step up, and step into facing your fears, making your bold moves, and living life without apologies. Now let's get to the show. Hello, Life Uncloseted family. It's time once again for another episode of the podcast and family. Ooh, family, divorce, marriages, coming out, not coming out, staying in, not staying in. It's all a crazy journey that some of us, many of us, find. I mean, the whole family thing can be a journey in and of itself. Like, how do I finally be who I am? And then who stays in my life? Who doesn't stay in my life? What do we do when we have kids and don't have kids? What do we do when we have kids and then suddenly we have grandkids? Well, today, my guest has kind of lived every bit of what I just described. He and I have a lot of stuff in common around, you know, going into the closet and staying there and then coming out and then going back into the closet, finding our way through divorces and marriages, and then finally finding the person, our person that we could be with for a lengthy amount of time. But then what do you do when you face all of these different things? Well, today, my guest, Kevin O'Connor, will be joining us to talk about his journey, all the different things that he's been going through. We're also going to talk about his book. He's got a great book out there that I just feel like shows all these different ways that we as families and humans move through grief and the interesting ways that we, you know, do what we do in our world as human beings. His book is called Two Floors Above Grief, a memoir of two families in the unique place that we called home. So I'm so excited to have Kevin here. And we're just a few weeks away from Pride Month, so we're going to start to pre-celebrate that. So, Kevin, thanks for being here and coming and sharing your truth, your story. Even though it's not Pride Month, I think it'll help some people go, okay, here's another reason why Pride should mean something to me. So,
yeah,
thanks for being here.
And every month is Pride Month. So.
Well, exactly. If you take pride in yourself and you own your truth and be who you're meant to be, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So so anyway, again, I know your book's been out for a little while here, but I always love talking to other authors about their work and their creativity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But let's kind of talk about some of the stuff that kind of, you know, I alluded to, like you and I both hid in the closet and then came out and then went back in and then came out again. You did it a couple of times before you're finally like, hey, here's my truth. But most of the time when this kind of story comes up, I always find there's a common thread here. Like, well, I did it for everybody else. Everybody said this is what I needed to do, or I wasn't ready to be out, or, you know, you alluded to in our pre-chat that, you know, I kind of thought this was the only way I could have kids. I had that feeling too. And then of course, once I was out of the closet, I'm like, wait, there's a whole bunch of other people who did this journey too. But what was some of the stuff that was like really the hardest piece of you? Like, okay, I don't know if I can come out yet. What was your personal journey like of not being able to come out?
Good question. And I guess that question was in the back of my mind, or those thinkings were in the back of my mind from the time I was a teenager on. Because I knew there was something that I was born in 1950. So in the 60s, we weren't using terms like gay so much at the time.
Yeah.
But I knew there was something that I thought was special about me. And I didn't quite know what to do with that. And so what kept, to answer your question, what probably kept me closeted or kept me not was the was fear. In my teens, 20s, 30s, what about my family? What about my parents? What about my brothers? What about my cousins? What about my friends? What are they going to think? What am I going to do? How can I be married and gay? How can I be unmarried and gay? Those kind of questions became pervasive, but pervasive and also buried, because one way that I think I kept putting off, I think I know, one way I put off answering those questions was to just involve myself in a career, educator, or a teacher, principal, getting my master's and doctorate degrees, those kind of things, taking valuing my profession, really, really, really enjoying it. And it gave me a place that I didn't always have to deal with that pit in my stomach that said, "Hey, what are you gonna do about this gay stuff?" And I just kept it there.
It's a
And
fascinating thing that happens a lot. I mean, I've coached a lot of people through the coming out process. And well, there's a couple of common threads. One is many of them have a relationship with somebody that they met right out of high school or right in their college years. And they're like, okay, this works. I can make this work, right? And most of the time they really love that person. There wasn't like, these typically aren't the quote, the golden gays, like, oh no, I've never been with a woman, right? But so that's a common thread. And the other piece of that is in that relationship, they're both very content with each other, but their marriages are just kind of, it's kind of quote flatline, not dead, but like, it's just, we're just showing up. We're just here. But the person that's the one that does want to come out, it's finally eating them alive that they can't do this anymore. The second piece of that that's very common is most everybody I've ever coached threw themselves into something, whether it was the marriage or their careers, and sometimes both. They just like, let's go do this, let's go be this, let's go, because it is a way of keeping everything at bay, pulling the wool over people's eyes, so to speak. Like, okay, if I do this, then hey, everybody else thinks I'm good. So I hear you, bud. I feel you. I went there myself.
Oh,
And
yeah.
it's hard because you're like, oh, look, everybody thinks I'm such a good person, right? Which we are. Not going to say we aren't. So what was the biggest challenge as you went through? Because you were married twice, you have, kids, now you have grandkids. What was the hardest piece for you of staying in the closet?
Well, the hardest piece then, I think, it came when my youngest child, we had our he was 16 at the time, so 24 years ago. And we living in our house together as a family. And we had gone through different phases of family counseling, and I think we were probably in family counseling at the time, or at least each of us making an appearance with the counselor. Can't remember all. The teens probably weren't doing it that much, but in any case, in our house at the time, I started to realize that through different indications I got from computers and print material that was around the house that my younger son was probably gay. And he left enough signs that I was familiar with myself because I was doing that. So I mentioned that to his mom, and I just said that I sat down and talked to him about it. And I was, he didn't deny it. He didn't say he was or anything. He didn't, where'd that stuff on the computer come from? I don't know, Dad. But anyway, as I was having this discussion or discussions with him, in my head, I had another discussion going on saying, "Kev, how can you, as good intentioned as you are with working with your son to try to offer some assistance, where's your authenticity? How can you, what's your role here, Kev? What are you doing?" And I really came to grips then. And I think I mentioned earlier, I was seeing a counselor, and I came to grips with, okay, I put this off long enough. I need to start talking about this and bring it out on the table. And it did in my counseling sessions. I left the house for a while. And then my wife said, "I'll come to counseling with you." And then I was able to lay it out on the table a little bit there. She had also asked me one time, "Are you gay?" And I said, "Well, I do have an attraction to men," at which point she left the house. But I that's that was this that was there is no final straw, but that was a propellant for sure. Aching for my own son, wanting him. To I treasured his life. I I wanted him to be safe. I wanted him to be to know who he was. But at the same time, I thought, I gotta talk about who I am. So that unfolded and into a whole thing about our marital proceedings and what we were gonna do. And we made the decision to split up, and me to move to a different portion of the house and move out. This is all during the time to my son had already gotten out of high school by that time. Both kids were out, but still making those moves, which I had never made before or ever. And then and being able to be upfront with my dad had been long deceased by then, but being able to talk to my mom about it, and still and being a school principal in a town that was area that was pretty conservative. And I had 2 years left in my contract. I was already put in for my retirement, but I wasn't going to be a soap. I called it a soapbox gay, where I would stand up and get on a platform and say, I'm gay, I'm out, I'm this, I'm that. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. Even though legally I knew I wasn't, couldn't lose my job or anything like that. But and through the counseling of my mother and my discussions with my mother, she said, let's get the I think it's enough for the family to just get used to the idea that you're getting divorced. That's enough to go. And then we'll talk about, we can have the discussion later with everybody. Well, I mean, the word did to get out slowly anyway. But once the divorce became final, by that time my kids were 20, 24 and 22. By the time my divorce became final, I was unable to, I did talk to them both directly about it and helped delay that. I talked to my brothers about it. Some of the fears I had about being pushed out or pushed away did not happen. All the things that kept me in the closet about those fears weren't happening. And as I worked through the starting to tell people at work, or as I got closer to retirement, starting to unpack that part of myself for family and friends, there was little to no of that pushback that I had feared for all those years. So I guess people were looking at a bigger person, I mean, a person who I am, with just gay being part of that. And
Which is always a beautiful way to see it, you
and
know. I've
I
always maintained, you know, gay is just an element of who I am. It
yeah.
doesn't, you know, it doesn't predominate my life, but it is who I am, no more than being a dad. A dad is a
Right.
part of my life, you know.
Right.
Being a guy that's bald is part of my life, you know. It's just these things, you know. Now, I'm not saying that to diminish being gay, because, you know, me being gay is actually one of the most beautiful pieces of who I believe makes me me.
Oh
But no different than being a father is another beautiful piece of who makes me me, you know? And I think sometimes where we can make some mistakes in this whole coming out journey is forcing people to accept this is who we are. Like, this is who, you know, just this is who I am. I would embrace you if you do accept me. I really would like to. But when we get so bent on, okay, but they have to, guess what? If somebody's not going to accept you, then walk away from that energy and go put it somewhere else where people really want to embrace you, has always been my philosophy. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn. It was really hard, because, man, I wanted everybody to, like, march in time. You got to accept me. This is how it is. And I've found it so interesting throughout the years that the more I let go of, hey, fine, I don't have to accept them either. If they don't accept me, that's fine. Then, you know, then maybe this is where, you know, the chapter closes on that chapter, you know, of my life, so to speak. But then as soon as I let that chapter close, it's always been really interesting, Kevin. It gets to get spent in such a beautiful different space. And then I'm actually find myself happier. There was a whole year I didn't speak to my parents, and that wasn't that long ago. And it was tough, because, you know, they were at an age where I'm like, you know, this should be the times that we can have. But I'm like, I'm putting too much energy in trying to make them love me the way I want to be loved. And instead of accepting. And so I think these are all pieces of the puzzle. I'm so glad you shared like that whole piece of, hey, we came to this realization and it was kind of my son, but there was actually another woman in your life who initially like really helped you start to see, quote, see the light that you knew was there, but you weren't accepting. So your first wife actually had a huge influence on you starting to open the doors.
Yeah. When we were married in 1975 and we lived in the Bay Area of your state, California, during the whole time that Harvey Milk was so involved in San Francisco and everything that was going on. We moved back to the Midwest just 3 months before the Moscone Milk murders. Mm-hmm. So we were there when he was doing all his activism, so I was presented with this right in my face in terms of being a teacher, and then so much the political thing there at the time was the referendums about gay teachers. So that was sort of right in my face, but I wasn't involved. I was pretty closeted. But in that time, I was able to talk to my wife. I'd say, I think I'm attracted to men too. Mm-hmm. And here we are happily married and starting this life, which then our married life had been about 2 or 3 years old at the time. But she just listened. And I say the word just, I don't mean to minimize what she did, but she listened and she said, well, I wonder who you could talk to about this. And then through her and through other people, I started going to counseling and had never thought I'd do that before. And then when we moved back to the Midwest where we were from, I continued the counseling. And as did she with her counselor, with another counselor. We had to change counselors because we were changing states, of course. But so when I look back at that part of my history, my journey, to know that I had that kind of initial support. And then as we worked with our marriage counselors and stuff, I made the decision, probably more my decision than hers at the time, to leave the marriage. Mm-hmm. And certainly that wasn't easy. She went her way, I went mine. But then what did I do? I started getting back into a dating scene and meeting people. And within, 2 years of our split up, maybe about a year of our formal divorce, 18 months from our formal divorce, I was married again. And, about to become a father. So life changes in so quickly ways. And sometimes I look back in my own journey, I did have control over some of that stuff. Other things I probably didn't have control. Other things I probably think I should have had more control, but I can't go back. That's just the way my journey evolved.
Well, so I think that's the thing, our journey evolves. These are the important pieces.
Yes, and I think, but each step I took out, each time I went back in, each time I made those transitions, I got a little, and sometimes there are big intervals, like when I had my kids, there was like a 25-year interval. But when I really started to come out at age 54, 55, and talk to more people about it, it got easier. It got easier to be who I was when I saw people that were accepting of this or not accepting. I think my second wife probably had the hardest time out of all those people that I was starting to come out to. But still, each time I did, I felt more authenticated and more who I was and more whole. And I hadn't felt that way in my life before. I mean, I've been carrying around like, when I've been working with kids in high schools about coming out and stuff, why'd you wait so long? And I said, well, I talk about the pit in my stomach that I carried around for a long time. And it's so nice not to have that pit there anymore. And not to know that what I'm presenting to people is what I feel inside. And that's been a huge release and bonus to me.
Well, it is, and that it's that interesting pit that it is somewhat self-induced, because we know that if we could just go be this, some of that would go away. Mm-hmm. But it's not as easy as going, okay, fine, I'm just going to do this, and boof, it's gone. Because there's other people involved, obviously. There's always going to be other people involved, no matter, and all of you listening, if you're sitting on the fence thinking about coming out, guess what? One of the inevitables is there's going to be other people involved. So you just need to embrace that there's going to be other people's lives you touch when you come out, good, bad, or indifferent. That's just what happens. But getting stuck in that thought of, okay, but I'm going to hurt so many other people. Okay, yes, but hurt is somewhat self-induced too. Like, just you living your life is up to the other person to decide how it hurts them. Now, granted, going through a divorce, all these sort of things. Oh my gosh, you didn't tell me this. Well, you know, we've heard all the different stories. I mean, I was one of those mm-hmm, stories. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So take ownership of what you can take ownership of. But then the other person is actually, from my perspective, when these things happen, they're being invited to also take ownership of going, but was this really working? Was this really working? Did you really, you know, were you really having the relationship you thought you had? Yes, probably on the surface. But below the surface, even with that pit in your stomach that maybe nobody else could see, there were probably signs like the relationship really wasn't what it really was, you know, but that's a danger mm-hmm. there. Like, we don't want people to know that there's something wrong in quote paradise, right? I mean, when it right, happened for right. us, I can't tell you how many friends were like, I never would have saw this coming. And I finally said mm-hmm. to one of my good friends, I said, you know, I hate to be flippant, but it's because I'm pretty good at making things look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And she goes, you're a good actor. I said, I hate to say that. Mm-hmm. Yes. But I said, I was acting to get through it. I was acting yeah. to try to survive. I was acting to try to like hold it all together. It's not like, ooh, let's do this and let's create this pain and this suffering and everything. That was never the intention. And I think a lot of times, and even in present day, given the state of where things are going, I mean, you live in Florida, so don't have to talk much about like how the LGBTQ community is being starting to be viewed in that state. But we're about to go back to where we were. If people are going to have to go hide who they are again, we're getting ready to repeat the same old patterns. And the thing is if you don't want to see, quote, families broke apart, you don't want somebody hurt because this has become something that they had to hide, then let's not go back there. Let's start being accepting of this is who, you know, if you don't want to be gay, then don't be gay. If you don't want to be in a gay marriage, then don't get married to somebody who's gay. Let's be real about this. But what we're about to embark on, if all this stuff gets worse by the day, we're going to go back to right where you and I lived for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I'm already seeing it. I'm already seeing it. And, you know, I'm not saying my coaching practice is going down the tubes, but the frequency of those coming in at this point to talk about coming out is definitely diminished a little bit. And I'm like, oh, okay,
interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm not mm-hmm. surprised, because I think the state of the world and, you know, things is there. But on the other side, now you've been together for a significant amount of time with your husband. Mm-hmm. Between the two of you, you said you've got several kids, and then you even your granddad. So, wow.
Right.
That's a mm-hmm. whole different coming out, I would think.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And
I mean, just the in-law thing alone. I mean, that's always been something for us. Our oldest one is getting married, and we've met the in-laws one time. That's it.
Yeah.
We don't live in the same state, so that's not surprising. We go to see the kids a lot of time. There hasn't been time to really interact with them mostly, but that was always like one of those things like, okay, wow, how do I do this now? Right. But then I did it. You tend to do it.
Yeah. And I think what I've found is it's not so much, how do I do this? It's just, okay, let's meet them. Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Yep.
I have found for myself in those situations. And I think I've been able to get here the last 20 years because I've been able to come out and be more authentic. I don't go into those new people situations with thinking, what are they going to think? Mm-hmm. I just come in and say, hey, this is, I'm Kevin. This is my husband, Leon. Yeah. Good to meet you. Let's, what part of the table you're going to sit at tonight? You know, just like it would be any other social gathering, whether it's initial gathering or whether it's the next time or the next time. And now when I go to family gatherings, I don't
It's just part of being what we do.
I don't do a lot of anxious stuff. I probably I'm thinking this right now off the top of my head. I was probably maybe more anxious when I was married to my wives about going into some situations. Because then it was, boy, what if they ever found out that I was gay or they had all these thoughts in my head, or that he's really not being honest, you know? And I would venturing back, and I was probably thinking that and more anxious than I am now about social situations and professional situations.
100%.
Yeah,
I mean, we what
it's
at that
so much
time
better.
we were living in Orange County, California, young married couple, two little girls, and we lived in a condo community. And so there was a lot of young married couples that were our friends. And I always felt like I was having to put on like this, well, it was a mask. I was having to put on the, super heterosexual, masculine male sort of guy. And I'm like, I couldn't let that mask drop, right? On the flip side, I'm looking at a couple of guys in the group and I'm like, damn, they're just hot. They're just hot and sexy, right? And it was like, I could never let that be seen, right? But what was so interesting is after this all unraveled, we remained friends with some of them. And there were a couple of the couples that were like, you're really a different Rick than you were when you were married to her. I'm like, yeah, we really like this Rick, and it was like really interesting to see that switch, and one of the guys is like, I was kind of wondering, because you always like, he goes, I'm just gonna say, you always seem to be checking me out. And I laughed and I said, well, yeah, you're really a handsome guy. You're something to be checked out, man. And he just laughed. And so it was interesting to see that dynamic like open up. But to your point about getting in these social situations, and I'll give you a really good example. My husband and I just recently went on a trip to Spain and Portugal. And typically when we travel, we don't go all gay, but we have done our fair share of let's go with some of the gay travel organizations and, be with our brothers and sisters in our LGBTQ community. And we had just done a big gay cruise to the Polynesia, but we also had this other trip planned to Spain and Portugal with a winery that we belong to here in the Central Coast, California. Love the owners, love the winemaker. And we decided, yeah, let's go do this trip. Let's do something that's not our norm, right? There was a few anxious moments coming up to even signing up for it. I'm like, I think we need to have a conversation with, the owners of the winery, because they're good people, super good people. But they're also very Christian. We've picked up on that. We weren't 100% sure how they felt about us, right? And so we did like a conversation like, hey, we just want to, say we don't want to make any of your guests, because we know there are probably going to be a lot of your friends that are being invited on this, wine excursion trip. We're going to be who we are, but we don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable. That was probably one of the biggest steps I've ever taken in that kind of a setting. And the winemaker said, here's the way I look at it. If anybody has a problem with my boys, then that's on them. And that was the moment I'm like, okay, this guy, whatever else he may feel, he really has got our back. And we're really, I mean, the friendship and everything, but it was another one of those coming out times. And the whole social situation, I was just like, we're just going to show up. We're just showing up. We just happen to be two guys that happen to be married. We're doing this. We have a love of our wine, just like everybody else on this boat. That's what it is. It's a wine river trip. There's a commonality. We all want to be. And I think to your point, Kevin, the more you just show up and you just show up, you just show up. You don't make anything out of it. I've always told my clients that I coach, the more you make out about you being gay and being gay, the more doorway you open for somebody to make something about it. If you just show up, most of the time, nothing will be said. And even if it does get said, it's probably going to be said after you walk away, because most people aren't going to make a scene in front of a lot of other people. Those that do, well, are those that do. And most of the time, those that do are the ones that everybody else is going to go, why was this necessary to do this in this setting?
So, what do you love? What do you love most about now this new life of, being you, being a parent, being a grandparent? What's one of the things that you most enjoy about that freedom of being you?
Well, part, oh, a couple of things come to mind. When I was before I retired from my job, the first many years of my job, I wasn't out. I was a school principal in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. That wasn't part of my persona. So that was always something that I hid professionally. But the last 8 to 10 years of my career, from, well, 15, from 2008 till 2020, it was Kevin O'Connor. Yes, this is his husband, Leon. But it wasn't Kevin O'Connor, gay educator, Kevin O'Connor, gay this. It's Kevin O'Connor. He's working with in our Department of Diversity. And but I didn't go into my presentation saying, yeah, I'm a gay man. I'm Kevin O'Connor. I'm here to talk to you about diversity. I'm here to talk about what we can do for you and your family and your kids about their identities and their authenticity. But I didn't feel I needed to. So I like that part. I like that part to be of being who I am, with Leon and our family. And when I came into this family, I was Leon's partner, now husband. So it was never a factor of are they gay or are they not gay? It was never a factor. And when the kids, the Leon's granddaughters wanted to figure out a way to when the well. They wanted to know what to call me. And when one of the kids had a baby 10 years ago, that particular couple called me and said, "What do you want to be called? We can call you Kevin, or what do you want to be called?" And so I was very honored with the question. And I did a little, a little thinking. And I said, "Okay, the Irish form of grandpa is Da, Da. Why don't you call me Da?" And so all six granddaughters call me Da, and that's just something that has been very up. You ask what is the best part? Well, that's another best part. It's just that I'm a grandpa. I'm the one of the patriarchs. I'm a grandpa, and this is who I am, and this is who Leon and I are together as a couple, and who we represent. And I really like that part. And when I'm involved in political work, or theater work, or volunteer things, walking around town, I don't have to think about the secret anymore. It's just this is who I am, and I don't go to into new organizations or thinking, oh, what are they going to think about me? I don't even worry about that anymore.
That's
I
awesome.
want to volunteer. I want to help. I want to be a part of this group. I'm Kevin. This is my husband, Leon. And then let it go from there. Yeah. And I
And again,
don't,
whoever
that's
has
the
a
best
problem
part.
with it,
That's their problem.
it is their problem, I just, I don't, there were a few times that I was a little more uncomfortable, and I was probably more comfortable at times than my husband. He had been out to his family and everything since he was in his 20s. And so when I came in, I'm like, cool, we'd be in Target or somewhere. And I'm like, hey, honey. And I get kind of feeling like kind of flinch on that. Like, oh, wait, I was to kind of already to the point in my big bold self, like, this is just the way it is. So I've waited 36 years to finally get to just be me. So I'm just going to be me. But it wasn't a rub your face in it sort of thing. It's just, this is my natural way. I call my spouse honey, like that's just a natural thing for me, But it's interesting you bring up the grandkid thing about what are you going to call? Because I've been thinking about that a little bit. My oldest one who's getting married, her and her fiance, have a nephew, little guy, 18 months old, always getting videos of him and everything. I'm like, oh, okay, is this their way of like, we're gonna as soon as we're ready, we're gonna, and I'm like, okay. And I thought, well, okay, so what will they call us? I mean, I'm assuming I'll be called grandpa, but there's going to be two, right? But interestingly enough, our daughters have always, my husband's name is George, But they've always called him Georgie. And I'm like, I bet he'll be Papa Georgie. I bet he'll be Papa George. That'll be my gut right there.
Sure.
And I may just be Grandpa, or I could be Papa Rick, you know? I'm called Papa Bear by a lot of people. So who knows, who knows where it goes. Right. But there's another piece of this that, you know, I didn't, you know, before we wrap up, I want to make sure we get this in. How much has you coming out and living your truth led you to this beautiful place of being an author and writing books like the one that you have out? Was that something that was always in you, or was that something that kind of, now that you felt the freedom, the book kind of came out?
Okay, great. The book was always in me. It's just a story about my upbringing and as a son and nephew of undertakers. And they had purchased an old Victorian house in the late 1930s and converted it into the funeral home on the first floor, and then used the upper two floors and converted those into apartments. And my mom and dad, they took the third floor, and that had been a ballroom of this Victorian house, and they made that into the apartment, and that's where I lived. So when I came home from the hospital in 1950, when they brought me home, I was put into a crib next to a stage that had been in this ballroom on the third floor of this Victorian house.
Wow.
So I knew from a young age that I was in a unique environment because when I would go to my kids'
houses.
You were
in your own version of 6 feet under, it sounds
like to me. Yes, I was. Yes, I was. Yeah, yeah. One person asked me last podcast I was on recently, who's one person you'd like to meet? And I said, Alan Ball. I'd like to meet Alan Ball from 6 feet under, the writer of that. But anyway, yeah, I was living that even before that concept was fictionalized. One of the reviewers on Amazon says, this is the real 6 feet under family. And so I always knew I had these unique experiences, and so the stories were always in my head. And, but I was always busy with work and school, and someday I'll write this book. Someday I'll write this book. Someday I want to be an author. I don't know what I'm going to write about, but yet I had all these stories. And then the other thing that occurred during all this time was different family members and myself had saved handwritten letters that were written from the 1930s up till the 1970s, about 700 pages of them. And I became the keeper of those letters. And so the motivation to write the book came as I started to organize those letters in the last few years of my principal career in the late 2005, 2006, 2007. So I got all these things organized, these letters, and that's a whole story in itself. But then as I read through them, I realized, hey, when you talk about authenticity, these are the real words of the people that lived in my life. These are the real words of the characters. So what motivated me to write the book was having that content in my head and in my hand, and then also people in my family saying, who's going to write all this stuff down? We've got so many stories to tell. And I come from a large family. So, and there was my aunt and uncle had three daughters. My mom and dad had three sons. And we lived as two families in this one house in what I call conjoined apartments. In order for me to get up to my third floor apartment, I had to walk through my aunt and uncle's second floor apartment. So there was always this interchange, this dialogue. So, and was often the case in funeral director families that you live in or near the funeral home. But ours was unusual because we had two families there. And we all got along. And there wasn't the kind of friction that you might find in 6 feet under. But I wanted to bring those stories out, how two families work together and what my responsibilities were as a kid. Sometimes people call it a coming of age book. I call it a memoir, but it is about my growing up from birth up to my early 20s in this environment and what I did with my friends, how I helped at the funeral home, what my responsibilities were, my interplay with my mom and dad and my aunt and uncle and my cousins, and how the group of us kept this business going and represented the community. The business is it's still existent. Wow. Almost 100. I mean, it's not, it has our name on the front, but it's not our ownership anymore. But to know what my dad and uncle created, I wanted to put that into words. And so that's why that was the motivation to write the book. And then the other motivation became real clear. It was when I retired from my educational job in 2020. And I thought, okay, Kev, no more excuses. Now's your time. Let's get going. And I disciplined myself with the help of classes and other people to help me get it all documented and written and published and the whole thing. So that's in, and I could go on and on, but that's sure. In a nut, that's in a nutshell how the book came to be.
Cool. And for all of our guests, the name of the book is again,
Two Floors Above Grief. And it's got the subtitle, like you said before, it's a memoir of two families in the unique place we called home. The unique place being this old Victorian house, which some people say in the reviews, the house itself is a character. And that's part of what was my intention in writing the book, to talk about the house and how if we had lived in a different environment, we might not have had the relationships we had and still have. And now our family, that family that was in that house, has about 150, 160 offspring. So in terms of children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, that kind of stuff. So it's a story for family, for our family, but also families that grow up in those kind of environments where you have a business, you have a place in the community. What are your responsibilities? We called ourselves ambassadors. I think that's true of a lot of kids whose fathers or mothers own a business in a town. So
nice. Very yeah. Nice. Any other books in the work?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple things. I got the ideas. I've got the seeds. I'm watering them, watering the seeds. One is just another. I had so many letters and so many things I didn't. There's going to be like a second part to this. And that's one of the things I talk about in the book is how do undertakers, how do funeral directors, what do they do with the grief they have? Where do they put it? They're taking care of so many people. What happens with the emotions they take on from others? So one of the things that I talked about, some other stories to tell are vacations and trips and things that the families took together. So it's sort of be a combination of travelogue and I call it navigating from grief and how our particular family did that. So I got that book in mind. I got a couple, having been a teacher and a principal for a few years, I have a couple professional books I want to get into. And I'm nice. I'm working on I'm just launching a brand and a different identities on social media called The Grief Navigator. So I'm working on that and working on ways that I can be of assistance to other people in the grief they experience. And this is not just grief that you might have from a death.
No, exactly. No.
But there's so many other ways we encounter grief in our lives.
Just coming out is a grief process. Mm-hmm,
definitely, just definitely.
You're letting a piece of, either you're letting your old self, quote, die, so to speak,
right,
and rebirthing into this new piece. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's grief of losing relationships and all these different things. And, you know, one of the things that I think many people miss, those of you listening, if you're kind of in this at any given time, is they miss allowing themselves and giving themselves permission to go through the stages of grief, whether it's losing a job, losing a family member, losing a relationship, losing yourself. I mean, there's a beautiful piece of losing yourself. I mean, I think you probably can relate to this, Kevin. I know for 36 years, I lost myself. I let myself die in many ways to a belief system that wasn't serving me.
No.
And then yes, when I came out, there was a whole other piece of myself like, well, wait, what am I letting go of and letting die? But yet when I really think about what I let go of to become myself, it was a false sense of who I was.
Right.
But even in that, there was some grief. Like I'm letting go of what I know, even though knowing that wasn't really who I was. And so there's so many beautiful things. So I love that you're working in this. I mean, grief is such a interesting area of our world as humans.
Oh yeah. And I've learned from my own experiences and, you know, thank goodness for Kubler-Ross that many years ago for putting into stages. Mm-hmm. But now the thinking is, and I agree with it, grief doesn't come in stages. You don't finish one stage and go on to the next.
Right, exactly.
I saw a schematic the other day, you know, we think that grief is going to go away or dissipate over a year, but no, grief stays sort of a level place in your life. Mm-hmm. And even my own dad, who's been gone 40 years, there's still, I get a tinge every once in a while when I think about something and know full well that he can't be here, but there's still, the grief comes in and out. And then now we've got, I've got a dog right here. So I've got, that is pretty sick. So it, there's a whole concept of anticipatory grief. And
yep.
Where do you put that? Where do you do that? Right. How do you handle that and make sure it's okay? You know, so, and I think that that's part of what I want to get into as I develop this whole identity as a grief navigator.
Nice.
Sort of like similar what you're doing with LGBT issues, I'm going to do the same thing with grief issues. And the topic of LGBT is certainly plays into that whole thing. That's for sure. Yeah.
Well, sir, I am so glad you took time out of your day to come have this conversation and share about your journey and opening up and coming out and being who you are and writing your books and all these things. And because it is a matter of showing up. I think the overriding theme here is just keep showing up. That's keep one of the most important things.
And just each time you show up, one other fear goes away and one other piece of anxiety goes away. Keep breathing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kevin, thank you again for your time. And everybody, you know, we're just a few weeks away from quote pride, but every day is a day to show your pride and be who you are.
Yes.
And breathe into it. Just keep breathing into it, especially in these days and times where, you know, it's just, we don't know exactly where we're going, but if we stay strong and stay together, we can weather through this storm as well. So
definitely.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. Appreciate it.
It's good to talk to you.
Hey, Life Uncloseted family. Another episode of Life Uncloseted has come to an end, and it is time for all of us to sashay away and go face our fears, make those bold moves, and stand up to living our life without apology. But before you do, I've got a favor to ask of you. Would you hop over to iTunes or Spotify or Podbean or wherever it is that you're listening to this and just give us a little bit of love if you like what we're doing here at Life Uncloseted. Here's what it does. It helps other people find the show. It helps other people get to know what we're all about. And you just might help change life. In fact, if you really want to change a life, we'd love it if you just ask a friend to take a listen and see what they think. So that's it. Love you all deeply. I'm Rick Clemens, the host of Life Uncloseted. And never stop stepping out, stepping up, and stepping in to living your life uncloseted.